listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.
And good evening, everyone. Good evening and welcome to History and You, the show where history matters because it's about you. It's about you in the here and the now. Did you know that history happens all the time because you create something every day? I'm your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and we're all very happy to bring you this show to share our stress, our doubts, our triumphs, struggles, and discomforts in trying to be better at what we are and what we do in life. If you want to call, please contribute your issues and insights at 323-203-0815 or that's 323-203-0815. If, on the other hand, you are shy about going on the air but want to contribute anyway, send me an email, please, at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find this information on the website. Well, tonight we have an interesting show for you. Up for discussion is a topic that affects us all in one way or another, a topic that some of us have come to fear. Some have embraced it, others are stressed by it, and many remain curious, even a bit giddy about it. So what is the mystical beast? Technology. And the inevitability of its pull, bringing us all in, kicking and screaming, or laughing and boasting, either way. I find myself wondering, has the power to think gotten us in trouble? After all, without technology, we wouldn't have the power to think. But since we have technology, we think. And what does thinking mean anyways? To think is to be self-conscious. And it's from this consciousness that thinking gives us an awareness of your immediate surroundings, for you to reason it and understand it. So when we think, we are using that capacity of consciousness and reason to create an idea, which have led us down the path of much innovation and productivity. But as an outgrowth of that same ability to think, there have been also just as many condemnations for our ability to create technologies beyond the point of moral reason. To the extent that we have been condemned to think is a question best left to Providence and the ages. Look, I know that some, perhaps even for many, it's a necessary adaptation in our lives. But does it really make the quality of our lives better? Does it violate any laws? Does it threaten the legitimacy of our democracy? Some will argue that despite the quirks and the blurps and the blips of our computerized, homogenized day may be of a slight inconvenience for us, but has technology of the everyday computerized type made our lives any better? More progressive, maybe? Happier, perhaps? Others will argue that technology and all it represents is what helps us to do more of the things we do. More efficiently and faster, of course. But have we come to a point where we've become scared of it, intimidated by it? Could we also be frustrated by the fact that some of us have a more agile capacity than others to assimilate new technology as it comes along? I know that technology helps us in the workplace, but should we do our jobs using technology as the be-all, end-all, while putting the human mind at rest? Some people get so enthralled with the use of technology that they forget to do their jobs. From smartphones, laptops, iPads, smart boards, to God knows what else, isn't all of this taking away from the need to be more personal with each other, more active in physical activity, instead of being more withdrawn and mentally dependent on the lure of the software world? Could these also be some early patterns for criminal behavior down the road, too? At this point, let me remind our audience, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. All of us here would love to hear from you. You know, despite all the warnings, people still text while driving. Hell, even teenagers text each other in the same room. Doesn't this also deprive us of the need to personally interact with peers? Even if only as a basic psychological requirement for adolescent character formation? Or is this the kind of texting behavior being used as a substitute to cover up certain inadequacies in your personality development? Look, I don't support the exclusion of technology. That would be ridiculous and equally unrealistic. However, the need to bring things into balance, the need to be moderate, and the need to see things in their proper perspective are all necessary components to becoming more effective and productive individuals. Technology works. It's useful. But it can never be regarded as something indispensable when compared to the human mind. Our ability to discern, to discover, to analyze, assess, create, sustain, and persevere in our individuality are all attributes that only the mind alone can initiate. So, is technology really attempting to replace the human mind? If so, what happens to us? I want you to reflect on this very closely, because technology in all of its forms is becoming a real concern as to how fast it's affecting the quality of our lives in every way and in everyday things we do. An alarm bell is sounding off in the distance, and people are still regarding it as too faint to hear. At this point, I want to read you an excerpt from the Axe Maker's Gift, an edition by Jeremy Tarcher, introducing James Burke and Robert Ornstein. And the excerpt goes as follows. This book is about the people who gave us the world in exchange for our minds. They are the axe makers, whose discoveries and innovations over thousands of years have gifted power in innumerable ways. To emperors, they gave us the power of death. To surgeons, the power of life. Each time the axe makers offered a new way to make us rich or safe or invincible or knowledgeable, we accepted the gift and used it to change the world. And when we changed the world, we changed our minds. For each gift redefined the way we thought, the values by which we lived, and the truths for which we died. And because each axe maker's gift was so attractive, not evil or ugly, we always came back for more, unmindful of the cost. Each time there was no choice but to adapt to the effects of the change that followed. For tens of thousands of years, it has been our practice to use the axe maker's gift to take what we wanted from the world without recompense. All that mattered was a rising standard of living. Unless we can appreciate that axe maker's gifts have always unleashed the kind of power that changes minds, we will not recognize that our survival now depends on harnessing the same power to save ourselves. Ladies and gentlemen, let me take a moment, another quick pause here to remind our audience, in case you're joining us late, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815, or send me an email, please, at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. All of us here would love to hear from you. Ladies and gentlemen, with me tonight is a gentleman whose qualifications as a technology guru far exceeds the standard expectations of a professional in the field, especially when it comes to understanding the nature of technology advancement and the dangers that it can represent. My guest has been involved in a number of engineering projects, film projects, and computer displays and simulations over the years, as well as being a fine educator in the field of computers and related technologies. Mr. Dean Morrell, welcome to the show, Dean.
Thank you, George. Pleasure to be here.
Dean, before we start, I think that we should take a moment now at this point of the program to give a thought and a moment of silence to all of those parents trying to endure an incredible loss as to what happened in Connecticut.
George, I too cannot begin to fathom the grief of the families who fell victim to the senseless act at Sandy Hook Elementary. And it is my wish, may those little angels whose lives ended on Friday, through the mercy of God, rest in peace.
Okay, let's just take a quick moment of pause to think about those poor parents. Okay, thank you very much. Dean, let's begin. I have several things to talk to you about because I really feel that technology is one of those things that threatens our lifestyle and our well-being in so many different ways. Let's begin with the issue of singularity, Dean. This is something very, very big that's looming over the horizon. Let's begin by having you tell us what is it exactly and how does it affect us?
Well, George, if you one were to ask a scientist what the singularity is, the scientist would probably say something to this effect. It is a point in space and time of infinite density where everything, all matter, emanated from via the Big Bang. Now, from a futurist perspective, one has to realize that this is not the definition that we're looking for. From a technologist perspective, machines, you have to realize that machines are fast approaching humans in terms of cognitive capacity, not just physical labor capacity.
And what is cognitive capacity more specifically, Dave?
Basically, logic and decision making. There's going to be a point very soon, according to technologists and scientists in the field of nanotechnology, where machines will become more intelligent than humans.
Oh my God!
Yes, the cognitive capacity will be far beyond that of human understanding.
Dean, you mentioned nanotechnology. What is that exactly?
Nanotechnology is technology where you manipulate matter on an atomic scale. And there are some revolutions now in nanotechnology and genetics and robotics that are basically going to lay the foundation for this thing known as the singularity.
So basically, you're talking about artificial intelligence, picking up where we last left off.
We're talking about three major things here, George. We're talking about machines being fully autonomous in their self-development. We're talking about machines surpassing humans in terms of their mental complexity. And we're also talking about the instantaneous self-improvement of these machines. Yeah. And more specifically, humans will not be able to process how quickly the technology in the future will occur.
Okay, so let me backtrack here for a minute, because before the show, we were having an interesting exchange here about this idea of singularity. And you mentioned something that was rather gripping and striking. You said something to the effect of, what if technology was able to enhance intelligence instead of being created by intelligence?
Correct.
If I understand that one particular line, are you trying to basically tell us that intelligence created by intelligence is basically going out the door and being supplanted or replaced by everything that is artificial?
What I'm saying is, according to the people in the field of nanotechnology, they are creating the possibility for the first time, George, a break in human evolution that will usher new technologies that so quickly and more powerful than humans can understand and can process, to the point where you'll be able to, and I truly believe this will be a possibility in the near future, a human will potentially be able to scan his consciousness onto a computer and live forever in a virtual reality simulation.
Well, then what happens to us?
What happens to human beings?
Yes.
Well, that's a great question. I think what will happen is that human beings will cease to evolve in the sense of what it is to be human.
Wow, that's remarkably striking. You're talking about coming to a point where we will become, we won't be able to keep pace with everything that is artificial.
Absolutely. In the post-singularity world, a human and a computer will live together sort of symbiotically. We already see things similar to this now with artificial parts, and there is an attempt in medicine to try to evolve towards something of
that
nature.
You know, Dean, when computers started making their debuts years ago, obviously, as we all know, I can recall specifically that one of the well-defined purposes behind computers is to free us, to liberate us, to do more things, to do other things, to do larger things that require more of a long view. This doesn't sound as if we are being spared to do larger and bigger things. This sounds as if we're going out to pasture. And we're being regarded as, for those Star Trek fans out there, that the very famous phrase that all of us should remember, a Captain Dunzel, so to speak, a part that plays no useful role.
Right.
There's no usefulness. I can't buy that, Dean. The human mind is this remarkable mechanism that is so dynamic and so fast that I find it difficult to assimilate the idea that an artificial intelligence will surpass that which has enabled us to survive adversity and adapt and be able to adjust and to do all of the things that are necessary to keep up with the changes throughout the centuries.
Right. If you are referring to the media and you're referring to things like Star Trek and Captain Dunzel, you have to go back and you have to see the history of the investigation of the singularity in such a field. 2001, A Space Odyssey, for example. Some people think that 2001 depicts a sort of like a fear of technology or a fear of what's to come. However, it's not 2001. It's not either pro-technology or anti-technology. It's really about man's relationship with technology. And to me, the story basically proposes that technology has been and will always be integral to mankind's development.
All right. So give us a timetable here, Dean. How much time do we have before any of these things begin to take place?
Well, if you ask someone like Ray Kurzweil, who's one of the most noted futurists, we're talking about we're beginning to see evidence of the singularity as early as 2030 or 2045. We're talking about within the next 50 years.
Wow, that's incredible. Let me ask you something along the economic realm of things.
Sure.
The existence of computers being smarter than humans, could they produce economic outputs that we're just not ready for at this moment?
Okay, let me give you a little scenario here. Supposing, George, you could build a house of any size, you could build anything you want inside of the house, you could build it from any material that you want, you could have it self-sustained in terms of power, there would be nothing substantial in terms of costs. You wouldn't be able to trade anything with anyone else. Economics would cease to be meaningful within the singularity. Economics, as we know it, would cease to exist. There would be a new type of economics that would be more aesthetics than goods and services.
All right. Now, Dean, let me take a step back from what you just said, because you just made a very, very riveting comment. Making the claim that economics is no longer going to matter, okay? How many people out there do you think are really buying this stuff?
Only the people that are really heavy into science fiction and heavy into into the promise of a future where technology is
is a primordial reaction. Yes,
exactly.
Agreed. I cannot buy the idea that you are going to shortchange the impulse to be ambitious.
Right.
To the impulse to want more. The impulse that human nature gives us to have a drive toward things. Are you trying to sit there and tell me that artificial intelligence will render all of this gradually mute?
If one looks at what is currently going on in the field of nanotechnology, in the field of artificial intelligence, if one predicts and assumes that the singularity will be very close to happening, then you also would realize that the singularity will drive the production costs and energy costs to near zero. Okay? People must and will seek out other ways of creating economic systems.
Ideas will be more important than
materials.
I don't see that happening. I think that in the here and now, I think history has shown us that economics matters. Economics is relevant. Economics is necessary to determine the kind of class and living standards that you're going to be living out your life under. Artificial intelligence, unless you're talking about a government that exceeds in its regulation, some might call it socialism, others might simply call it an overly regulatory government caught up in its own zeal. However, or whichever way you want to label it, you may be talking about a different scenario under an artificial intelligence dictating all of this. But economics is probably one of the strongest relationships there exists out there. Money is an extremely strong social relation. You want money, and you're going to do anything you can to get that money in order to secure your lifestyle. Artificial intelligence, I just don't see it supplanting or overriding any of that.
Money, economics, supply and demand, all of these ideas, George, are ideas that will not be important in the singularity. Instead of owning things, instead of competing for materials, the mercantile exchange in Chicago, for example,
right,
instead of trying to set market prices for things, what's going to be important will be how things are arranged aesthetically in a virtual world.
Okay, now, Dean, let me ask you real quickly, just to move on. Mm-hmm. How much of a role have movies played into all this?
That's a great question. I think Hollywood has had a love-hate relationship with technology. And I go back to the movie 2001. I go back to shows like Star Trek, the original episodes.
Right.
Technology, I think the message for of these movies and these shows has been pretty much that technology is necessary in order for mankind's development. But I think also one of the things that they've needed to reconcile in these movies like 2001 is that man must also somehow overcome technology in order to progress past a certain point.
Well, if movies have had this free hand in trying to sell to the public and enchant the public and some might even say dupe the public into the idea of believing certain extrapolations beyond what realistically and currently exists, isn't any of this censored by the government?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So how much does the government have the right to censor what's going on here in relation to the internet and artificial intelligence?
Well, it's interesting that you make this jump to censorship because lately, a few days ago, there was a conference in Dubai where something like 143 countries were represented. And basically, the theme of the conference was centered on updating the telecommunications codes globally. There was concern by the United States, for example, that countries like Russia and China wanted too much control of the internet and internet commerce and communication. Now, historically, the United States has always played an active role in this realm of censorship. In 1996, for example, the government passed the Communications Decency Act, where right. Basically they were trying to protect children from predators and so forth in right. Cyberspace. And then, of course, Clinton came in 98 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. But here's the main issue, George. Here's the main issue. The as I see it, the fundamental problem is the very idea of regulating the internet through a body where only like the government has a voice.
Right.
That to me is a big problem because a big part of what makes the internet so dynamic is the fact that it is, to me, the one of the biggest experiments in democracy in the history of humanity.
Yeah, it's almost as if censorship is really playing against the whole idea of prior restraint.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to censor something, it's going to be too late to censor because prior restraint is probably most applicable after you've published whatever it is you've published, and then you got to take back what's already been out there, what's
correct.
Already been exposed.
Absolutely.
Okay, so censorship really is something that it's almost like a mockery, like, you know, playing fools to people's aspirations or what they want to do in relation to freedom of the press and freedom of speech.
And there were attempts by the government, by the U.S. government, with regulations like SOPA and PIPA. There was an attempt to wipe out prior restraint.
Well, let me ask you this in relation to, now that we're talking about prior restraint, the whole idea of the internet being politicized. Mm-hmm. I know that Obama has done a lot to try and politicize the internet and to use politics to his advantage, whether it was in communicating or getting a message out there or using it for his reelection campaign or his original election campaign. How could you give us a quick comment, please, because we're moving right along with time. How would you describe the degree of politics involved with the whole dissemination of the internet as it grows ever so rapidly?
Well, I can think back, for example, to 2004, where the Rock the Vote campaign registered over a million new voters. I could talk about the influence of social media, George, and the fact that, for example, in 2008, Facebook gave a tremendous impetus to political activity. Social media services like Twitter was basically instrumental in Barack Obama's campaign in 2008.
Yeah, and, that 1 month that he set a record for, I think it was $32 million in a month or something.
And of those $32 million on that particular month, 28 of which was raised through online donations. So I feel that through online marketing, through ads, through email campaigns, and through social media, there's been a tremendous political upheaval when it comes to the internet and political campaigns.
You know, there's one more issue here that I wanted to touch upon in relation to social media. Now that you mentioned social media, are we thinking of business models as it relates to mobile platforms of social media?
Right.
This is somewhat of a scary situation, because if you're considering replacing business models for the social media and the kind of support that it's bringing up in the rear, you're talking about something extraordinarily revolutionary.
Well, there's been a 9% increase over the last few years in the percentage of businesses doing social media. About 50%, George, of businesses are using social media to try to gain new customers. I personally don't think that businesses really know at this point how social media can generate a profit.
I mean, is there any way of getting around it? Is there any way of doing something else that disallows you from getting caught up in the whole social media current?
I don't think so. I think social media is here to stay. I think people are trying to make an online presence. I think as years go by, there's going to be more of a demand for venture capital, people that are willing to risk their money. They're going to want to see.
But here again, now we're talking about the economics. The economics that you mentioned a moment ago, artificial intelligence would phase out. And here we have investors investing in social media. It's almost something contradictory here. What's going on?
Absolutely. I agree.
So then economics cannot be supplanted. It cannot be replaced.
Well, that's because we haven't reached the singularity yet.
Well,
once we reach it, I think everything is going.
Singularity is a very, very scary issue, at least for me, because I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
To us as human beings, it's like I mentioned a moment ago, I feel as if I'm going out to pasture, as if I just don't matter anymore. In any event, this seems to creep up on us very, very quickly, and it is something to think about. Dean, I want to take this moment to thank you for taking time to come on the show and share with us your concerns and insights on technology. It was informative, eye-opening, at the very least, and equally appreciated. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me on your show, George.
And now we've come to the final part of our show, where all of us here wish to leave you with a final thought to consider and further reflect regarding the technology of our time and what is yet to come. Some final thoughts. Technology oftentimes seems to be one of those things we hardly take notice, whether it's because of exciting new updates to our smartphone capacities or new games to play, to fill up the idle spots in our day, whatever the reason, technology has a way of making its presence known. And it's also through that presence that technology creates for a person a dependence, a need to rely, a habit, a flirtation with fiction, a demand, a purchasing power, an obsession. It's astonishing to me how we've come to depend so heavily on certain technologies today that we would never consider giving any thought to, say, 40 years ago. For example, I can remember going to school without air conditioning. Transistor radios were in vogue. And yes, the days were hot during summer, but we didn't think much about it. I can still remember my family leaving the house for a day's work and returning back at the end of the day without cell phones or smart devices in tow. And we still had all our friends and contacts. Nothing changed. And if we called someone on the telephone and the line was busy, we waited. And then we called back later. We learned patience and limits without instant gratification to spoil us. As a child, I can remember having to go to family gatherings over the holidays and watching everyone there talk to each other. In contrast, I recently went and visited my daughter and granddaughters in a similar but smaller gathering of the family, and no one, and I mean no one, was talking. Oh, except to their smartphones and laptops, of course. I can't tell you the number of times I've gone out to dinner and seen so many other people in neighboring tables, each relating to their devices in so cozy a manner as if to romanticize some secret lover locked inside a metal box. You know, it's funny because I've always thought that someday our future would lie with the government mandating that we get mental engrams surgically implanted in our brains as a substitute for the poor communication that words and language has offered mankind throughout the ages. My friends and I would laugh about it. We aren't laughing anymore. And if artificial intelligence does indeed render the mind more idle, our mental faculties will be further arrested and diminished in meeting the challenges that kept our attitudes and outlooks healthy and forever busy. So what does all of this mean? Well, it means we've decided to stop thinking about what is threatening our need to think more broadly, our need to think more alertly, and our need to think more smartly. And what is that? That is the quiet incense that lurks behind the hush of subliminal technology. Don't forget to catch our show for my Christmas special next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. by visiting our website at latalkradio.com and look for History and You. As your guest for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling wishing all of you a very pleasant evening. Good night.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.